we drag her into the hole. We use the dirt and the mud that we've unearthed to cover her up. We canvass the forest, gathering whatever detritus we can find, leaves and sticks. We lay those on top of the mud. Shelby's body shows as a protuberance from the earth, but it's slight. With any luck, no one will find her here. At some point in our drive home, it stops raining. B stops just short of our houses, pulling to the side of the street. "What are we doing?" I ask. B kills the engine. She says only, "Follow me." We get out of the car and start moving down the sidewalk. We're both filthy, caked with mud. It's on my clothes, my hands, my shoes. It's in my hair. B asks if I have bleach. I tell her I do. By now, the rain has washed Shelby's blood from the street. It's no longer visible. No one will know it was there. But B's trunk still shows evidence of blood. That needs to be cleaned. "Where is it?" she asks, walking fast. Her legs are longer than mine. She doesn't wait up for me. I have to jog to keep up. "In the garage," I say. It's where Josh and I keep all the cleaning supplies, so that Wyatt and the kids can't get into them by accident. We come to my house. It's surreal standing outside it at this time of night. I don't recognize my own yard. "Go get it," she says about the bleach. "I'll wait here." She stands in the yard. The yard is wooded. The neighborhood is hundreds of years old. Some of the trees were here before the homes. They provide coverage. No one can see us, we think. My house is dark. The porch lights are off. Josh must have forgotten to turn them on for me. He often does. It has to be the middle of the night. If Josh were to wake, he'd be worried. But Josh is a sound sleeper. The odds of him waking up are slim. It's far more likely one of the kids would wake up and come looking for me. I wonder about Jason. Is he sound asleep like Josh? Or is he awake, worried, wondering why Shelby isn't home from her run? I slink into the garage. I leave the lights off. I move by rote. I find the bleach and return to B. It's cold outside. Only now, as the adrenaline slows, do I notice. I start to shiver. It's slight at first, but then turns considerable. My body jerks. B takes the bleach from my hand.
"I'll take it from here," she says. "Go take a shower and go to bed. And remember, not a word to anyone. Do you hear? Not a word."
I offer to help B clean. She doesn't want my help. Before she leaves, she makes me strip naked.
"Why?"
I ask.
"Just do it," she says.
On my own front lawn, I stand and strip down to my underwear and bra. I'm too devastated to be self-conscious. B takes my clothes from me.
"What are you doing with those?" I ask.
"They're covered in mud, in blood."
"I have to get rid of them. They're evidence," is what she says. And then, "Go home, Meredith. Go home to your husband and kids. Forget all about what happened tonight."
She starts to walk away from me. I grab her arm.
"And if I can't?" I ask, knowing I'll never forget this night.
"You need to,"
she says, as she shrugs me off and leaves.
Leo. Now. I don't go to the hypnosis. I go to school because Dad makes me go. He's worried I've missed so many days that I'm starting to fall behind. The day sucks, as school days do. When I get home, you and Dad are in the kitchen. I come in and overhear you tell Dad that you're sorry. I hang back by the door, watching you, wondering what you're sorry for. You look so small. You stare down at your hands, picking at hangnails that you've torn and bitten off. Dad's bought you clothes of your own, and even though they fit right, they're not right. Girls don't wear clothes like that these days, because Dad had to shop in the little girls section and not the one for teens. There's a panda bear on your shirt. It has rainbows for ears. A girl like Piper Hanaka wouldn't be caught dead wearing that. "I'm sorry, sir," you say again. Dad tells you, "There's nothing to be sorry for. You didn't know. How could you have known?" There's a quaver to Dad's voice. I know it by heart. He just barely manages to keep the valve closed so the waterworks don't begin. As I watch, Dad puts his arms out like he might hug you. You shrink back, banging into the countertop. Dad gets the point. He puts his arms down, knowing you're more of a trauma victim than his daughter. You may never be the daughter he used to know. Dad hasn't gone back to work since you've been home. He's on what's called FMLA. He isn't getting paid, but that doesn't matter because we have money. Dad's a workaholic. After you and Mom left, he would rather have been at work than home with me. We never went on vacation or did anything fun. He thinks he's undeserving of nice things. His car is a 12-year-old Passat with 100,000 miles on it, when he could easily afford the same Mercedes-Benz the neighbors just got. "It's not your fault," Dad says. I close the front door and let my backpack drop loud enough that you know I'm home. I go to the kitchen. "How did it go?" I ask. I help myself to an apple, sink my teeth into it. You and Dad are mute. "The hypnosis," I say with a mouthful of apple, because no one's answering me. "How did it go?" "Good," Dad says, busying himself making dinner. He takes ground beef from the refrigerator, a skillet from the cabinet. He sets the skillet down lightly, careful to keep noise to a minimum for your sake. "It was very informative. We learned a lot. I'm glad we did it." Talk about beating around the bush. I look from Dad to you. You stand with your shoulders rounded, your head slumped forward. I take another bite of my apple. My question this time is less open-ended. "What did you find out?" It's quiet at first. Everyone's disinclined to tell me. I wait it out, and in the end, you're the one who does. "Gus ain't real," you say. You shuffle your feet, staring down at them so that your hair falls in your eyes. My jaw hits the floor. "What do you mean he isn't real?" You're red-faced when you say it. "Gus is pretend. I made him all up." This gets a rise out of me. After all that Dad has done for you, you go and do something stupid like this. You got Dad and the cops all worked up about some kid who didn't exist. "Why would you do that?" I ask.
"I didn't mean to."
"What do you mean you didn't mean to?" I'm mad because a person doesn't just go and invent another person by accident. You did it for attention, for a reaction. "Leave it be, Leo," Dad says. His voice is stern. He frowns at me. But I won't leave it be. "She's a liar, Dad." You pull a face. Dad does too. I might as well have hit you. "Don't call your sister names." "But she is," I say. "She's not." "Then what is she? A schizo?" It's out of my mouth before I can think better of it. I don't mean to be a jerkweed. I just am. But I'm pissed, because I thought you and I were getting close. I thought you were opening up to me. Turns out I was wrong. Dad slams a wooden spoon on the countertop. The sound is loud. "Damn it, Leo! Just shut up! You don't know what you're talking about!" In all my life, Dad's never told me to shut up. You freak out because of the noise. You're shaking. You start to cry. Or maybe that's pretend too. Maybe you're making that up just to dupe us. Dad coaxes you into a chair. He gets you something to drink. He gets you one of those pills the shrink prescribed for you. If I lied, Dad would take my internet away for a month. You lie, and he babies you. After you're done shitting your pants, Dad goes back to his ground beef. I stand there, watching the whole thing, and then leave. No one asks about my day.
Meredith. 11 years before. May. The next morning, I'm sore. My whole body aches. I wake to Josh's lips teasing mine. My eyes open, and there he is, suspended above me.
You were supposed to wake me up when you got home, he razzes me. We had a date.
I'm sorry, I say. My saliva is thick, my mouth like cotton. It's hard to swallow.
Don't tell me you forgot.
I'll make it up to you. I have trouble getting out of bed. It takes time. The room spins. I have a headache, one that creeps up the back of my neck. Josh, watching me, laughs.
Looks like you and Bea had fun after we left.
My cheeks flame. Josh doesn't know the half of it. All he knows is that Bea and I stayed at the bar and had another drink after he and Kate left. He thinks I'm hungover.
What time did you get home? I tried staying up for a while,
he says. And I tell him that I don't know, that we lost track of time. Bea didn't want to leave, I say. What I wouldn't give to go back to last night. To go home with Josh instead of staying with Bea. I push myself from bed. I think that when Josh looks at me, I must look different, changed. Last night, after I let myself in, I showered in our first floor bathroom. I couldn't risk waking him or the kids. I went to bed with my hair still wet. That was only 4 or 5 hours ago. If he looks closely enough, he'll see it's still wet.
You want coffee?
Josh asks, standing at the mirror, fixing his tie. I say yes, though I'm not sure I can hold anything down.
Just give me a minute. I'll brew a fresh pot.
I'm no sooner on my feet than I have to rush past Josh and to the toilet. I fall to my knees before it, grasping the seat with clammy hands. The 3 or 4 drinks I had last night are not enough to make me sick. It's what came after that lays waste to my insides.
Wow,
Josh says, coming up behind me. He stands in the bathroom doorway, smirking proudly as I wipe the vomit from my mouth with the back of a hand.
That was a heck of a birthday celebration. You sure showed Bea a good time. She's lucky to have you.
I'm not known as being the life of the party. I'm more of a wet blanket when it comes to nights out. I'm typically the first to want to go home. This is uncharacteristic of me. Josh is relishing the idea of me being hungover because it doesn't happen often. He fetches a washcloth from the vanity. He soaks it in cold water and hands it to me. As I take it, I see mud still buried beneath my fingernails, despite my scrubbing last night. I hide my hands from Josh. My telltale heart is beating. Word begins to spread later that day. It starts on Facebook. It starts as a plea. Shelby and I are Facebook friends, as I'm Facebook friends with many of my clients. Shelby is tagged in another friend's post. That friend is looking for her. That evening, Shelby makes the local news. Josh and I watch together. The kids are in bed. It's the 10 o'clock news. I freeze up when the story breaks, barely daring to breathe as the anchorwoman talks about Shelby. I should tell Josh that I know her. I should tell Josh she's a client. But I get cold feet. I hesitate because I've never been much of an actor. I worry my reaction would come off as unauthentic and give me away. And then, because I didn't do it right away, I can't tell him later, because he'd want to know why I didn't tell him before. It's the same as what happened with Marty. As the days go on, I can't tell him about the malpractice suit or Dr. Feingold or any of it, because it would all look so dodgy and dishonest. I brood over the police coming by, asking if I know Shelby, and me having to decide whether to lie. If I lie, I'd never get away with it. But if I told the truth, it might get back to Josh, and then he'd discover the lie by omission. It's a catch-22. I can't win. The next day, Bea comes to the house. I'm alone when she comes. "Should we be seen together?" I ask when we're behind closed doors.
"Why would that matter, Meredith?" she asks.
"Because of what we did," I hiss under my breath.
"And what was that?" she asks. "Go to the bar and have a good time?"
She tells me that to avoid suspicion, I have to act normal. I recoil, offended. "I am acting normal," I say. Though I'm not. I'm far from it. Bea asks what I would do if a client of mine ever went missing. "I don't know," I say, controlling the sudden urge to cry. Bea, before me, is impassive, tall. She looms over me in the foyer of my home. She didn't bring an umbrella, and so she's wet. She drips onto my entry rug. "It's never happened before."
"Don't be stupid," she says,
deadpan. It comes as a slap to the face.
"Theoretically, Meredith, what would you do?"
I swallow hard. "I'd call her husband, express my condolences, see if there's anything I can do."
"Then do it," she commands. "Do it today."
She leaves the same way she came. I walk to the front window to watch her go, to be sure she's really gone. Outside, the world is charcoal gray. It's foggy. I can only see to the other side of the street. The world beyond evanesces into clouds. In the coming days, police descend upon our neighborhood like snow in winter. I watch from a distance. No one comes to our house asking questions, though I obsess over what I'll do when and if that happens. What we learn from word of mouth and the news. Josh is all worked up about it.
"How does a grown woman just disappear?"
he asks no one in particular. He's pacing the house. He tells me that he doesn't want me out after dark for anything. Not until they find the person who did this to her. "You're going to drive me to and from my births?" I challenge. "Wake the kids up in the middle of the night and make them come?" He thinks it through. His answer to this is,
"You'll take a cab. The driver can drop you off and pick you up at the hospital door."
"You're being ridiculous," I say, trying hard to control the tremor in my voice. "You do hear what they're saying, don't you? About the husband? How he killed her? I think I'm safe unless you have plans of killing me," I say, fleeing the room. I'm more contrary than I should be. The guilt ravages me. Not only Shelby's death, but that Jason may take the fall for it.
"Are you mad?"
Josh asks when he finds me later in the bathroom getting ready for bed.
"Did I upset you?"
He comes up behind me. He lays a tender hand on my lower back. He wraps around me from behind, so that his arms circle my midriff. He knots his hands. He lowers his chin to my shoulder. He says,
I couldn't live without you.
I don't deserve Josh after what I've done. Josh is a good man. I can only stand it a few seconds before I free myself of his hold.
What's wrong, Meredith?
He asks. Nothing, I snap at him. I'm fine.
You don't seem fine.
I am fine. I find myself searching things online. How exactly does one die in an auto ped accident? Head trauma is often to blame. So too is organ damage, internal bleeding, damage to major arteries. I get sucked down a rabbit hole of information. Shelby's body should have ricocheted off the hood of the car when we hit her, because of the force of impact and because of Newton's laws of motion. She shouldn't have toppled over in front of it. This leads me to believe she wasn't standing upright, that she was hunkered down, doing something as innocuous as tying a shoe. Who'd ever think you could be killed while tying a shoe? Another thing I look up. Do corpses make sounds after death? The answer is yes. When a body is moved after death, the air left in the windpipe can escape. The result is a groan or a moan. I obsess over this. I try to replay the sound I heard as we laid Shelby in the trunk of B's car. Was it the contents of her trachea leaving, or was she still alive? Did Shelby ricochet off the hood of the car and land in front of it? Or like a domino, did she fall over? It doesn't matter. Either way, she's still dead. The rain won't let up for anything. I'm tormented by images of Shelby cold and naked, lying in the rain, shivering, soaked to the bone. I can't stand it. One morning, I stand at my closet, looking for something to wear. My mind screams at me to pick something. Just pick something. The indecision paralyzes me. It's like this every day. But it isn't just the clothes. It's every one of the seemingly million inconsequential decisions I make every day. The kids are at my feet, arguing. I don't have the energy to react. Their voices sound muffled as if I'm underwater and they're up above, as I stare into the endless abyss that is my closet. It's all too much. I settle on something. I get in the car. I take the kids where they need to be, though Leo begs and cries as I leave him with Charlotte. I can't go on with this guilt. I can't live like this, thinking of nothing but what B and I did. All day and night, I replay the moment of impact in my mind. I feel it still, the car crashing into her, and then, seconds later, the repulsive sensation of driving over her body, not once, but twice. I'm snowed under by what ifs. What if I'd gone home with Josh? What if B and I hadn't had that last drink? What if I'd insisted on driving? What if Shelby had been on the sidewalk? What if her shoe hadn't come untied? If she hadn't been bent down tying it? If that's even what happened? The guilt is a heavy burden to bear. I feel battle-scarred. I go to the store. I no longer enjoy driving. I'm over-attentive. I drive below the speed limit. I step on the brakes when I see even the slightest movement in my peripheral vision. My heart races the entire time. It's not that I think I will be hurt. It's that I think I will hurt someone else. My hands on the steering wheel are slick. I can't get a good grip of the leather. Cars honk at me. I've become a danger because of my extreme caution. At the store, I buy a blanket. It's plaid and fleece. I take it to the woods alone, where I last saw Shelby. I have to search a while because the trees, the riverbank, all look the same to me, though the river is higher than it was the last time I was here. The days have become squally. We no longer see the sun. I find Shelby. It's been days since her death. The sight of her wrecks me. She's still mostly buried, but the rain has washed much of the forest floor away. I see parts of her. A single bloated leg lying on a bed of miry leaves. Strands of her dyed hair. I wear gloves as I take the blanket out of its packaging. I use care not to touch it. I go to her, lay the blanket on what's visible of her body. I don't want to look, but I can't tear my eyes away. What I see is unspeakable. Where the blood has settled, Shelby is purple. Gravity has taken its toll, pulling the stagnant blood down. Her lower half is entirely bruised. The flies have discovered Shelby's body. They buzz around. They land on her. I try to dispel them, but they're not scared of me. They leave, and then they come back. When I look closely at Shelby's body, there are maggots. What I don't think about is my shoe prints left in the mud. I see them only as I'm leaving. I've seen enough cop shows to know that this is how people get caught. For a split second, I think about leaving the footprints there. Then it's out of my hands. If I'm meant to be caught, I will be. I think somewhere deep inside, that's what I want. To be caught. But I can't do it. I step out of my shoes. I retrace my steps. I sink to my knees, smear the shoes tread away with my gloved hands, moving backward. By the time I'm done, I'm bathed in mud. I let the rain rinse me clean. I carry what remains into the car with me. Halfway home, I have to pull to the side of the road to hurl. Now when I think of her, she's alone, but at least she's not cold. It's the only thing that gets me through the night.
Leo. Now. Before bed, Dad comes into my room, where I'm doing algebra. Algebra is about the only class I like, because there's a right and wrong answer, and no in-between. There's no gray area, unlike in life. Life is all gray area. Can I come in? Dad asks. I shrug. It's your house. Don't be like that, Leo. Then how do you want me to be? I'm not usually so stubborn. He comes in and sits on the edge of my bed. I turn my back to him. I want you to listen, to hear me out. You're not giving her a fair shake. I turn around in my chair. I look at him. It's a swivel chair. I can go back to not looking anytime I want. I tell him, I'm listening. The way I say it is petulant. All my life I've had to be a grown-up. It's nice acting like a child for a change. Dad ages every day. He aged about a decade when Mom died. He's aged another now that you're home. His hair is gray. He has a paunch. There are dark circles under his eyes because he doesn't sleep. He's always tired. He doesn't eat much either. Not real food, though he's taken to feeding his depression with potato chips and beer. It's the reason for the paunch. He was an athlete once. I was a skeptic when he told me he competed in a marathon before I was born. I called bullshit. He showed me the medal to prove it. The only reason he ever runs now is when there's been a potential sighting of you. I don't remember Dad before, but there are the pictures, the home videos. In them, he's pretty jacked. He's a stud, He has brown hair, and plenty of it. His hair wasn't thin like it is now. It wasn't gray. His smile wasn't bogus back then either. He's let himself go. The way the psychiatrist explained it to me, Dad says, being isolated in the dark for as long as your sister was drives people to the brink of insanity. It impairs their sense of time, their sleep cycles. Without being able to see, they suffer sensory deprivation. It fucks them up, Leo, he says. I go rigid because Dad just said fuck. Dad doesn't swear. This friend of Delilah's was a hallucination. But to her, he says, he was entirely real. Where she was kept, she had no one to talk to. She couldn't see anything in the dark. In the absence of all other stimuli, Leo, her mind kept working. And it created Gus, who, to your sister, was as real as you are to me. She wasn't lying. She's not a liar. She believed 110% that Gus was real. It's possible that Gus was the only thing that got her through all this. When he says it like that, I feel like a shithead for calling you a liar and a schizo. Dad doesn't make me apologize. I do it anyway. I get an idea then. I ask Dad to drag out the home videos, and we watch them. For just a little while, it's like you are you again, and Mom is still alive.
Meredith, 11 years before. May. I can't keep going on like this. Josh can tell that something is wrong. He asks me about it. He saunters up behind me when I'm at the stove or the sink. He massages my shoulders. As he does, I tense up. It isn't that I don't want Josh touching me. It has nothing to do with Josh. It's that Shelby is on my mind all the time. I see her when I'm awake. I see her when I'm lucky enough to sleep. The memory of her lying naked on that bed of leaves makes my flesh crawl. It will only be a matter of time before the animals find her, if they haven't already. Josh says things to me like,
"Hey, babe, everything okay?"
And that trite old saying,
"Penny for your thoughts,"
because he can tell I'm being pensive. I shrug him off when he does, tell him I'm fine. He says that he's beginning to hate that word, fine. The tension between us grows exponentially. Bea comes by almost every day. She skulks over when I'm home alone. She must monitor my comings and goings or keep an eagle eye on my car in the driveway. When she comes, I ask her things like, "What did you do with my clothes?" And, "What did you do with Shelby's clothes?" I feel breathless all the time, in a constant state of panic. What makes it worse is having to hide my feelings from Josh and the rest of the world. Only when Bea is here can I speak freely. Bea, on the contrary, is always composed. She tells me not to worry about it.
"I took care of it," she says, about the clothes,
which doesn't answer my question. Took care of it how?
"You didn't go to work today,"
Bea says accusatorially.
"You had a class to teach at 9. I saw it on the website. You should have been there."
I'm not feeling well. It's not a lie. Guilt isn't only emotional. It manifests itself in very physical ways. My head aches, my back aches, my stomach is in knots, and I'm constipated. I could never stay focused through class, much less make it through without that overwhelming urge to vomit or cry. I spend so much time ruminating about what Bea and I did that night, second-guessing the choices we made, the choices I made. I can't get away from it. I'm obsessed. My mind is in a constant state of flux. I can think of nothing else but what happened that night. I don't sleep.
I barely eat.
You need to act normal, Meredith. Normal.
I'm not particularly religious. Josh, the kids, and I go to church on Easter and Christmas, but that's all. Still, there's a Bible verse that's been running never-ending through my mind since sometime last night. The truth will set you free. It sounds so simple. I make the mistake of telling B.
We'll make the police see it was an accident, that you didn't mean to hit Shelby, I say. It was unpreventable. They'll understand.
B stares at me, incredulous.
Have you lost your damn mind? She snaps. They'll just fucking understand. I didn't step on a bug. I killed a person. We, Meredith, she says, we killed a person.
I plead with her. Please, B, I can't go on living like this.
You have to, she says. You have to figure it out.
She takes a step closer.
I was drunk, Meredith, and you knowingly permitted me to drive the car home. It's your fault as much as it is mine. You'll go to jail too, you know, if we're ever found out. How do you think Josh and the kids would fare while you're rotting away in jail for years?
I've thought about this. I have an answer ready. It's not like they can do a breathalyzer now. It's too late to prove anything, and if you weren't drinking, it's a much lesser offense, like a misdemeanor. For a second, she just stares, and then,
are you really that dumb? Since when did you turn into a lawyer anyway?
I see now that B isn't hamstrung by the same guilt as me. The bee I know isn't cruel. She's compassionate. She's outspoken, but kind. This bee is scared.
We're not just talking manslaughter anymore or a misdemeanor, she says, because we also carried her out to the woods and hid her. That's concealment of a homicide.
She pauses for effect.
It's time you set your fucking conscience aside and think about your kids.
After she leaves, I collapse into an armchair. I don't move until 6 hours later when I hear Josh and the kids come home. I hear them outside first. I try and make myself look busy before they come in.
Leo. Now. Back at school, Piper Hanaka comes up to me.
Hey, Leo, can I show you something?
I'm at my locker, trying to open it for the third time because Adam Beltner already slammed it shut on me twice. I let it slide both times. He called me a wuss for it. If I'd have fought back, he would have exterminated me. I can't win, no matter what I do. You're lucky you never got to experience high school. High school is pretty fucked up. I tell Piper, sure, okay, I guess. It's game day, which means the cheerleaders wear their uniforms. The skirts are short enough that Piper is all legs. It barely covers her crotch. I learned the hard way that I'm not supposed to look at her legs because if I do, I get called things like petey and perv. So I don't look at her at all. I pretend to be looking for something in my locker.
I saw Delilah's picture in the paper.
Yeah, me too.
It's all so sad.
Yeah, I know.
Except it's supposed to be happy too, because she's like, back.
I don't know what to say. So I say, what do you want to show me? I've never had a girlfriend before. I've never even had a girl like me. Freshman year, someone told me in gym class that some girl named Molly liked me. I still have nightmares about it. It took me 3 days to get the guts to ask her to the homecoming dance. Turns out it was all a hoax. Kids laughed their asses off at my expense when she said no. Molly already had a date, a junior on the varsity football team, built like a linebacker, because he was. Piper says,
"My mom, like, made me get rid of everything Delilah after she disappeared. She didn't think it was healthy to have it around. It sucked. Like, I used to have half of a best friend's necklace that I shared with Delilah. My mom made me toss my half in the trash. She was all like, it doesn't mean anything without the other half. I cried over it. So she went and bought me a new best friend's necklace and told me I could give it to anyone I wanted. I might have been six, but you don't just, like, forget your best friend.
Who'd you give it to?
Lily Morris. Do you remember her? She doesn't even live here anymore. She moved to, like, North Carolina when we were 12.
I shake my head. I don't remember her.
Doesn't matter. Lily was never a good friend anyway. In fourth grade, she started a rumor that I, like, peed my pants when I laughed.
I want to ask her if it's true. If it is, I'd find it endearing.
Anyway, my mom let me keep one picture of Delilah, though.
That's cool, I say. Though it was a dick move for Mrs. Hanaka to make her get rid of everything that reminded her of you. Dad, on the other hand, kept everything. Your rainbow glitter shoes are still by the door, and have been for 11 years. You've probably noticed. Piper shows me the picture. You're a little kid in it. It's a close-up of yours and Piper's faces smashed side by side together. You're smiling. Half your teeth are missing. You're all red hair and freckles. Happy, like the kid I saw dancing around on Dad's home videos. Not scared, like the person you now are.
It's just that I was, like, digging around on the internet, trying to figure out if cleft chins are one of those things that just goes away, you know? And they're not.
No matter what kids like Adam Beltner say, I'm no idiot. I know what Piper means by this. What I don't know is how to feel about it. Piper cut out the picture of you in the newspaper. The Hanakas might be the only people in the world who still get the actual physical newspaper. She sets both pictures side by side, the one some asshole photographer shot yesterday, and the one of you when you were six. They're mostly similar. Red hair, green eyes, except for that cleft chin. I never noticed before that you had a cleft chin. It's not something that's super obvious. It's on the small side, as cleft chins go, the kind of thing you might not notice unless someone else pointed it out for you. But now that I know it's there, it sticks out like a sore thumb. Except that on the picture taken yesterday, there's no cleft chin. None at all. Not even a small one. The bell rings. I look around and the halls are empty. We're late for class. Piper is backing away from me. She hugs her books to her.
Don't be mad at me, Leo,
she says, before she turns around and runs.
Meredith. 11 years before. May. I have a confession to make, Charlotte says. She's on the other end of my phone. Her tone is somber. It's evening. Josh and the kids have been home for hours. They're in the next room, watching TV together on the sofa. Josh has a book open on his lap, but he's laughing at the TV. It warms my heart that a 36-year-old man can find humor in preschool TV. Charlotte says, "Something happened." And there's the sense that she knows what B and I did. I go into a flat spin. I'm losing control. I'm in the kitchen when it happens. I've just finished washing dishes and wiping down the table. I pull out a chair and sink into it. "What's that?" I ask. I'm short of breath. My heart pounds in my chest. She says, "Someone has been picking on Leo." Before her voice cracks and she comes apart at the seams, saying, "Oh God, Meredith, I'm so sorry. I feel awful about it. I should have known." My mind doesn't change course so quickly.
How would you have known? It's my job to know these things, especially after you called about the bruise. I should have paid more attention after that. I should have put more stock into what you said. But instead, I cast it off as kids being kids. I'm so sorry, Meredith. I wish I'd known sooner that he was being picked on. Picked on how? I ask, still breathless. And by whom? Brody Parker, she says. The name doesn't ring a bell. What did this boy do to Leo? Well, she says, chastened. I'm ashamed to admit this, Meredith. I hope you'll forgive me. But this afternoon, he locked Leo in the outdoor toy chest. I picture our own plastic toy chest. It's maybe 2 feet high by 2 feet wide by 3 feet long. Leo, at his last exam, was 38 inches tall. If Charlotte's toy chest is about the same size as ours, that means Leo's little legs wouldn't have been able to stretch fully out inside it. He would have had to bend at the knees. But is there enough width inside the toy chest for that? And what about the toys inside it? Was he lying on them too? Or did this Brody Parker have the decency to remove those before forcing Leo in? My mind is racing. But all I can say is, it's raining outside, Charlotte. They were playing outside? Brody asked if they could get the Nerf guns and bring them in. I said yes, because with all this rain, we're running out of things to do. Brody asked if Leo could help him carry the guns back in. I said yes. Then one of the toddlers wet herself, and I got all caught up in changing and washing her clothes. I didn't know that Leo hadn't come back in. Brody, she says by way of explanation, goes to the elementary school. We walk and pick him up, same as we do Delilah. We didn't get home until close to 3:30, and then the kids wanted a snack before they played, so... Her voice drifts. She's holding something back. What are you saying, Charlotte? I ask. It was less than an hour that he had Leo locked inside that chest of mine. And I gasp, imagining Leo trapped in a dark, cold toy chest all alone for an hour. What grade is Brody Parker in? I ask, imagining him as a kindergartner, like Delilah. Fifth, Charlotte says. This would make him 10 or 11. What kind of 11-year-old boy picks on a 4-year-old? I wonder if Leo was lured into that toy chest, if he was double dog dared, or if this little hellion picked Leo up and forced him in. Why wouldn't Leo just get out of the chest? I ask. Leo may be shy, but he's a capable boy. He could have just climbed out. It has a lock on it. Dear God, I say, pressing a hand to my mouth. I wonder if there are air holes in that toy chest, how much oxygen it holds. And then, because I can't get her off my mind for anything, I go back to Shelby in the trunk. And whether she was dead before we put her in or if she died inside. Charlotte says, when it came time to clean up, I realized he was missing. Leo is always the first to clean up. He's such a good boy, Meredith. But Leo's puzzle never got put away, and that's when I knew something terrible had happened. I want you to know I've already called Brody's mother. I told her he's not welcome here anymore.
Leo. Now. Over dinner, I stare at you, wondering if the cleft chin only shows its face sometimes. But for as long as I stare, I never see it. It's not there. That night, I do some digging on the internet. I see the same thing Piper saw. The only way to get rid of a cleft chin is through surgery. That costs about $2,000 or $3,000. I seriously doubt those meth heads forked over a couple grand for a chin implant for you. I'm also doubting there's a plastic surgeon anywhere near Michael that could have done it. I compare the two pictures side by side. There are far more similarities than not. Most of the differences could be chalked up to time, like the way your nose has widened or your face narrowed. That happens as we grow up. Your hair is also darker. The sun lightens hair. Where you were at, there was no sun. But then, there's that cleft chin, also known by the internet as the incomplete fusion of the symphysis menti during fetal development. In layman's terms, a butt chin. It's rare. It's genetic. It's gone. You don't have it anymore. It isn't that you lost it. It's that you are not my sister. I don't know what to do with this information. Do I tell Dad and break his heart? Or let him go on believing this pipe dream of his? The odds of my sister ever coming home now are slim to none. As long as Dad thinks you're her, he's happy. He can get on with his life. He can have closure, albeit phony. You, whoever you are, who lived locked in someone's basement for 11 years, can have a better life. Dad will take care of you. He'll give you everything you need, except that you probably have your own folks out there. Maybe you have a kid brother too. They're probably missing you. I wait 2 days before I show Dad the pictures Piper showed me. At first, he flies off the handle, mad mostly at me for making shit up. But the longer he stares at those pictures, he sees.
The DNA test, Leo, he says, was conclusive. The DNA test confirmed that she's Delilah. DNA tests don't lie.
That is a major question mark, because DNA tests almost always get it right. There are rare errors that can be chalked up to the quality of the sample, or the way the sample was handled, or the results interpreted. We go to the police station. With you in another room, Dad corners the lady cop and one of her henchmen. He shows her the pictures. She's dismissive at first. You can't just think she'd look the exact same as she did when she was 6. People change, Josh. They grow up. That baby fat disappears, and features become more defined. That's all that's happening here. She ascribes Dad's fears to some form of PTSD, thinking that after all these years of missing Delilah, he has anxiety over losing her again. It's not that simple. I printed out the articles online that say cleft chins don't just vanish. They're here for life. She reads the article, and her face goes white.
What if the DNA test got it wrong? Dad asks.
DNA tests are lauded as extremely reliable, almost 100%.
I'd like to see those results, Dad says,
thinking the lab fucked up. There are things called a false positive and a coincidental match. The lady cop doesn't move. She holds stock still.
Carmen, he asks, I'd like to see the results, please. Though why, I don't know, because it's not like Dad, an investment banker, can make heads or tails of a DNA report.
I can get it, the henchman says.
No, the lady cop says quickly. Let me. She walks away. Dad's eyes follow her. She's not that bad looking, for an older lady. Like Dad, she's got to be pushing 50, though she takes better care of herself than Dad does. She looks like she works out, eats healthy and all that. Under her clothes, she's probably ripped. When she comes back, she's shaking her head. Her hands are empty. She says decisively, it wasn't there.
Ma'am? The henchman asks.
It wasn't there. The DNA report wasn't in the file. She is phlegmatic. Her voice is flat. She stares at the henchman, then Dad, unblinking.
Maybe you missed it. Those papers have a tendency to stick together. I can double check if you'd like, ma'am.
It wasn't there. I didn't miss it.
She's pissed now, for two things. One, that the report is missing, and two,
that the henchman second-guessed her in front of Dad and me. "Yes, ma'am," he says. The henchman offers to pull up the report online. "I can do it myself," she says. We follow her to a desk. She sits at the computer, fingers pecking away on the keyboard. Neither Dad nor I can see what's happening on the screen because we're on the wrong side of it. She stops typing. Her fingers hover above the keyboard. "What's wrong?" Dad asks. She starts. "I forgot my password, that's all. Just give me a minute." We do. It doesn't help. A minute later, she still can't remember her password to whatever software cops use. "Let me try mine," the henchman says, reaching past her for the keyboard. "Don't!" she snaps at him. "Just don't!" It's loud enough that people stare. Some other cop walks over and asks if everything is all right. Detective Rawlings is the undemonstrative type. She's seen everything there is to see in her line of work. She's become desensitized to all things bad. But still, you can see a tiny breach in her shell. It's visible. She looks at Dad. "We've been together from the very beginning, Josh. All the ups and downs of this case. I've watched you cope with the unbearable loss of your wife and child. I've seen firsthand your hope and resilience every time you thought there was a lead as to where Delilah might be. You never gave up on her." Her voice cracks. "You were hell-bent on searching until Delilah came home, and I told myself long ago that I was in this for the long haul. If you weren't giving up, neither was I. I grew fond of you over the years, Josh, and wanted more than anything to bring your little girl home to you. This wasn't just a case for me. It was personal. I should know better than that. You're never supposed to let it get personal. There's a line. You don't cross it. I did. And then I got the call we'd been waiting for 11 years. I was so certain she was Delilah, Josh. She checked off all the boxes. She looked like her. She said she was her. Unlike the imposters we've seen, this one was 100% legit. I could feel it in my bones. We'd done it. We'd found Delilah. I saw the relief and the euphoria in your eyes. This meant everything to you. And then the results came back. Negative. Not a match. I was incredulous. I was devastated. It was impossible. It couldn't be. I thought of how I'd tell you, the words I'd say. I practiced. But when the time came, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't take her away from you again. I'm so sorry, Josh. In some inane way, I thought I was doing the right thing. For you. For her. I thought, if no one knew the truth, what harm would it do? Dad openly cries. I can't badmouth him this time because I feel it too. A black hole inside me. The one question remaining now is why you thought Dad was your dad when he's not. We go into the room with you. It's like taking that long final walk to the execution chamber. I sit down in a chair next to you. Dad sits across from me. He can't bring himself to look at you. The lady cop doesn't come in with us. After her confession, she was led away by some superior officer with her head hung low. There will be some form of discipline for what she's done. Not only did she lie, but she tampered with police records. She'll probably get canned. Maybe have charges pressed against her too. I don't know. Instead of her, it's someone else asking the questions now. A man cop. He doesn't sit at all. He doesn't beat around the bush.
"What made you believe this man was your father?"
There's a tremor to your voice.
"He's not?"
Your face falls. You're helpless. Confused. Your eyes go to Dad, who's crying. That's your answer.
"No, he's not."
You blink over and over again, like there's an eyelash in your eye. You're mute at first. You pull your legs into you. You rock on the chair. It's raw, primal.
It's hard to watch. Tears pool in your eyes and then slip down your cheeks. That's how I know you're not lying. You honest to God believe him to be your dad. You say to him, "You are. You are my daddy." And then, even I'm crying too.
Meredith, 11 years before. May. In the middle of the night, Delilah cries out for me. It's a strangled cry, and then she's sobbing, gulping through her tears. I spring out of bed. I rush to her room, where I find Delilah sitting upright in bed, eyes like saucers. I go to her. At first touch, I know what's wrong. Delilah has spiked a fever. She's sweating through her sheets, despite the fact that she shivers violently. "Oh, sweetie," I say, stroking her damp hair. Her skin is clammy. Her pajamas stick to her. Delilah's eyes are fixed on the corner of the room. I look, but there's nothing there but a lamp. The lamp is a kid's floor lamp, tall, with three acrylic shades that look like balloons. Delilah's hand rises up from beneath her soggy sheets to point at it. "What, baby?" I ask, dropping down on the edge of the bed. "What do you see?"
"Someone's there," she says, voice hoarse.
I look again, feeling my heartbeats quicken. Though, of course, no one is there. It's Delilah's fever speaking. What she sees is the floor lamp, and she's mistaken one of the balloon-shaped lampshades for a head, the tall, narrow tube for a body. "No one's there," I assure her. "It's just your lamp. Want me to turn it on and show you?" I ask, as I press up from the bed and make my way toward the lamp. I don't wait for her to answer because Delilah is looking at me strangely. I reach a hand out for the switch. Delilah coughs. It's a barky, croup-like cough. Delilah has had croup before. I turn on the lamp. Yellow light floods the purple room. I look around, glance under the bed, inside the closet, make a big show of saying, "See? No one's here. It's just you and me." Delilah sounds so sure when she says, "They left, Mommy." I know that can't be. "Who was it?" I ask Delilah, humoring her. She blinks at me, unspeaking. Her stare is vacant, glassy-eyed. She doesn't say. Her red hair droops. Along the hairline, it's dark with sweat. I let it go, knowing no one was here. I reach a hand back out to turn off the lamp switch. I retrieve the thermometer from Leo and Delilah's bathroom and the children's Tylenol from downstairs. I take Delilah's temperature first. It's nearing 103 degrees. I double-check the dosing on the Tylenol and then give it to her. Delilah has sweat through the sheets. I make her get out of bed long enough for me to change them. She gets back in. I lie beside her. I stay with Delilah until she falls back to sleep. Then I go back to my own bed. I slip in beside a still sound asleep Josh. Josh has the ability to sleep through anything. I don't wake him because Delilah gets sick all the time. She's our germ magnet. If someone in her class is sick, you can bet your life Delilah will be too. Delilah's fever isn't breaking news. I can tell him in the morning. As I lie there, I notice that our bedroom window is open a crack. Josh runs warm. Even in the winter, he wants to open the bedroom window at night. Otherwise, he overheats. The cool spring air wafts in, blowing the gauzy curtains into the room. The rain falls lightly outside.
The sound of it is peaceful. If not for thoughts of Shelby that torment me, it would be anesthetizing. But instead, I lie there dwelling on how Grace Tebow will never have a mother to tend to her at night. It's all my fault. It makes me sick to think of. It makes me sick to know that while I lay in my soft, warm bed under the weight of my husband's arm, Shelby lies alone in the woods, her body being devoured by maggots and flies. I've reached the end of my rope. I can't keep living with this secret. I need to go to the police. I need to tell them what we've done and suffer the consequences. I deserve that. My own guilt aside, Jason deserves closure. He needs to know what happened to Shelby. I've been following the investigation on the news, and it's not good. All roads lead to Jason. Jason has been rumored to have been having an affair. It's damning. I'll never be able to live with myself if Jason gets convicted of murder. If that were to happen, what would happen to the baby? Who would raise her? Who would care for her special needs? Would she be institutionalized? At some point, I must have drifted off to sleep. Because when I wake up, Josh is gone. Beside me on the nightstand is a tepid coffee. The bedroom smells of his cologne. He was here, but now he's not. I get out of bed. I go downstairs to see if he's there, but he's already left for work. Back upstairs in their bedrooms, Delilah is still sound asleep, but Leo has begun to stir. Delilah won't be going to school today. I debate keeping Leo home. There's really no reason for him to go to Charlotte's if Delilah and I are home. But he's been having such a hard time at Charlotte's of late. It would be confusing to him if I were to keep him home. Tomorrow he'd cry twice as hard. And besides, Charlotte promised me that that Brody boy wouldn't be there. The thing Leo hates most about Charlotte's is gone. I can't just keep him here to catch Delilah's germs. I go into Leo's bedroom. He's out of bed, playing with his toys on the floor. I sit down beside him and pull him into my lap. "Hey, baby," I say, kissing the top of his head. His hair is mussed up. He smells like sleep. We play with his toys together for a while. It's a firehouse playset. He's the fireman while I'm the Dalmatian. There's a fire on the other side of the bedroom. Our fireman and dog hop in the toy fire truck and Leo pushes it across the floor to put the fire out. After a while, I say to Leo, "Miss Charlotte called last night. She said you've been having trouble with another boy at her house." I pause, wait for Leo's reaction. "A boy named Brody." Leo's whole body stiffens at the sound of this boy's name. His face turns red, his eyes fill with tears. I wrap my arms around him. "I wish I had known that this boy was being mean to you, Leo. I would have liked to help," I say. It isn't an indictment. I'm not blaming Leo for not telling me about the abuse. But I want Leo to know he can tell me anything. "Miss Charlotte says that Brody won't be coming back to her house to play. It's just you and the other kids from here on out." How does that sound? Leo shyly smiles. He likes the sound of that. Delilah wakes up. Her fever is back. She looks glassy-eyed. Her voice is rasping and she holds a hand to her throat like it hurts. I take her temperature. Again, it's 103. I give her another dose of medicine. I help her down the stairs to the sofa and get her something to drink. She has no appetite. She watches cartoons while Leo gets ready to go to Charlotte's house. Delilah waits in the car when I drop Leo off.
I tell Charlotte that Delilah won't be coming after school because she's sick. It's just Leo, I say. Leo steps up to the door,